listening. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk. My name is Linda Stansberry. I'm your host tonight. And I hope all of y'all listening out there in the audience will call in because it's my last night doing Thursday Night Talk. Tonight's subject, this is a good advice show. I have gathered some of the brightest, most experienced people in my life. They're all laughing like they don't believe me to give advice. And the subject tonight specifically is, what advice would you give your younger self? So I'm going to introduce y'all, and then I'm going to kind of lead off with an anecdote to illustrate that. So first of all, we have Jamie Carroll, who is going to school here at HSU. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, and you're starting school in, you think, international studies?
Yes.
Awesome. So glad you could join us. And for purposes of definition, for all of you listening out there, are you what you would call a millennial?
Yes.
Okay. So if you have questions for the millennials, we have one here in the audience, so, or here in the studio. And then right next to you is Susan Seaman, who is the program director for the AEDC. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And could you break down that acronym for us? Because I always forget it.
Sure. It's Arcata Economic Development Corporation, which is really misleading because we serve like six counties, but we started in Arcata, so.
And I want to give Susan props, first of all, for bringing Jamie. You said Jamie is a very bright person, so you wanted to bring her along. And then also, when I asked my Facebook friends who I should invite, I would say like three or four people said, Susan Seaman.
Yes.
Yay.
I'm a millennial fan, so they're probably all your millennial fans.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here. And then next up, we have Troy Williams, who was suggested by my producer, Geraldine Goldberg. Thanks for joining us, Troy.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. And then right next to me is Jesse Wheeler, who, it's hard to explain the context from which I know you, but you are a Humboldt County native. You grew up in Bridgeville. Your parents actually used to own Bridgeville, quote unquote.
My great grandparents did, and then my grandparents, and then my parents.
That's right. And you have been able to offer me some really good advice during my lifetime, so I'm so glad I have you with us.
Oh, thank you.
So, again, for context, what kind of got me on this topic is, okay, so I, Linda Stansberry, for those of you who can only hear my voice, you're not sure who's talking, I have been keeping a journal since I was about 12 years old, right? And so recently I was going back through them and, you know, reading all of the embarrassing stuff that's in your journals when you're a 14, 15-year-old girl. And I found my journal from the year I turned 17, and I found this entry, July 28th, whatever year it was, right? And I was like, well, I turned 17 tomorrow, and I really haven't accomplished everything that I was hoping I would accomplish on the time I turned 17. And, you know, I feel like I really just haven't been trying hard enough, and et cetera, et cetera. And I read this, and I'm like, oh, no. It's okay, kid. It's okay. Like, you don't need to solve the world's problems by the time you turn 17. Like, maybe just learn how to, like, do your hair and, you know, talk to boys and give yourself a break and have some fun. And it's not that it's not that I would want to be a different person at that age, because, like, I look at that and I was like, wow, I was so driven and so focused and I wanted to accomplish so much. And I think that's really cool. But I think the advice I would give, again, my 16, 17-year-old self would be, like, stop taking yourself so seriously, right? So maybe we could just go around and what advice would you give yourself at 16? What about you, Jamie?
Oh, interesting time at 16. 16 was an interesting year for me because I was a homeless kid in Humboldt County, so I might have a little bit of an unusual story. But I think if it's okay to say, I'd probably say wait, if you know what I'm saying. There's plenty of time for those sorts of experiences. Maybe focus a little more on yourself and who you want to be.
What about you, Susan?
So from my high school time, I definitely would go back and worry less about boys and more about building girl friendships. I had friends who were girls, but I just really value them now that I'm older. And I wish I had those, you know, kind of my group of people that you can rely on all the time. I just don't know that I understood how important it was then.
What about you, Troy?
Well, coming from a city like Los Angeles and just the chaos of the city that's in certain pockets, I would tell myself that to remember that you can't take it back. And what I mean when I say that is that there are many people that when they're young, and even now today, they make decisions that can hurt themselves or somebody else, and they oftentimes will end up like in a hospital or somewhere worse. And the first thing they would wish is, I wish I could take that moment back. And I would say that you can't take it back, so choose wisely. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes I go down the 299 and I see cars pass in the other lane and they're going real fast. And a couple of times I've seen near misses, you know, and I know that those people, if something were to happen, the first thing they would want to do is take it back. But you can't take it back, you know, so that's what I would tell myself, to remember that.
Mm-hmm. That's really profound. Yeah. Jesse?
I think I would want to tell myself to try to be where I was, because I lived between two different places all my school years for 10 years. I lived in Bridgeville and I boarded in Eureka to go to St. Bernard's. So I was home sometimes on the weekends and sometimes in Eureka. But I boarded with the nuns and I couldn't have friends outside. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty difficult. But when I was there, all I wanted to do was be home. Which I know that's a kid thing, but I was never able to appreciate where I was. And I look back on it, and over the years, and I've run into some of the nuns, and they were very good to us. You know, they were, the mean nun stories didn't apply here because they were pretty cool people. And they taught us a lot. They really taught us a lot. When I was in Bridgeville, I spent most of my time wishing I didn't have to go back to Eureka instead of being there and enjoying it. So I think I would say just try to be where I was and make the most of it.
I think that's good advice at any age. I think a lot of us really struggle with being present, appreciating what we have. And, you know, what Troy was saying, you know, reminded me of the fact that I think that Some of you guys are parents. I'm not a parent, and I don't know about you. Jamie's also not a parent.
Jamie shook the head real fast.
But when we talk about, you know, things that we can't take back, like one of the things that I was thinking about was how we behave towards others when we're young, and you know, bullying and the things that we can say or do to other people when we're still basically children, that can have a big impact. How do you guys talk to your kids about that? Did you make mistakes when you were younger that you want to talk to them, and do they listen?
I actually had a really interesting experience with my daughter when she was in fifth grade because she was a bully, and I wasn't. I was always the one that was very shy and stayed back. And I found out there's very little help for bullies. When you go out, you know, I would just look everywhere, like, what do I do? And everything was like, it's your fault. And I'm like, I'm trying really hard. And basically, she was small and different. And in order to protect herself, she was tough. And she really just needed to kind of figure out who she was and be happy with that. She got much better. She's fabulous now. But that was a hard time for me. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's also really interesting to be the parent of the one that's, you know, that's the bully. That's hard. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know what I told her. You know, I told her everything that you would expect to tell her, and then I sent her to other people. And that's part of my whole idea about having the tribe and having your your kind of girls around you that support you and tell you you're okay no matter what you're doing, because I would always tell her what she was doing wrong, but what she needed was a group of people telling her what she was doing right, and that was when she turned around.
Hmm.
So.
Well, how much responsibility do we give our kids when they're still kids, and how much responsibility do we give ourselves for the mistakes that we may have made when we were younger? Do we just go ahead and forgive, or is there actually, you know, some responsibility or something to learn from that that you can't get from forgiving? That's kind of a convoluted statement, sorry.
I'm not a parent. This is Jamie. but I think that there's a responsibility in understanding why it is we behave the way that we behave.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, as a auntie to many, I would hope that I could, you know, kind of get past what the action is and understand what the reaction is or why that's happening in the first place. And I think the responsibility that we have to ourselves is to continue to learn. So whatever that looks like, because it would be different for everyone and every child, you know, learning from whatever it is that's causing that would be important.
I don't have kids myself, but I remember way back when I was a little kid, there was a bully in our neighborhood, a guy named Preston. And I thought he was a really big guy. And I remember one time he was beating up my older brother. And I helped my older brother to fight him, you know, but still, he was a big guy. He was like in, I think he was in junior high already. And we were just in like elementary school. And years went by. And I saw this guy when I was about 17. And he was shorter than me, he was smaller than me, and he didn't remember me.
Mm-hmm.
But I remembered him because his face was imprinted. And I walked up to him, and I asked him, I said, "How you doing?" And he just kind of looked at me. I said, "You got something you got to say to me?" And he just didn't know who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Your name is Preston, huh?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "I told him my name, I'm Troy. My brother's name is Lloyd." And then it took him a while, then he finally realized. I said, "You got something to say?" And the guy said, I don't want no problems with you." And I thought I would feel really good hearing that, but it really didn't make me feel too good. I felt kind of bad because then I felt like a bully,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just walked off, you know. But what made him become like that, I don't know, you know. But I know that it was a feeling that I didn't like, you know. So, yeah. I don't know what I would tell the kid. Just, you know, it depends. You know, people have different personalities. But I would tell him you think it's going to be a happy feeling. You feel, you know, having power over someone like that. But it's hollow. It doesn't feel too good. You know, at least not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is your daughter still a bully, Susan? Is she in college right now, beating up people
yeah.
for the lunch money?
No, it was a pretty short-lived problem. She learned a lot. You know, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So she went through that process, and she was always angry. She mm-hmm. came out angry. She was angry growing up. And then one day I said, "I just want you to be happy." And she said, "You know, happy's not the only emotion."
Mm-hmm.
And then she, like, figured out how to sort of frame anger in a positive way. Like, why am I angry and how can I make that better? So by the time she was in high school, she was really, like, sophisticated about figuring that stuff out in a way that I'm probably still not, because I just avoid stuff. So she teaches me. Actually, I think that's really interesting. Younger people teach me stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wisdom comes with age, but it also comes with just listening to people who have different experiences and learning from them.
Absolutely. And, you know, it occurs to me, Jesse, we talk about this a lot because we come from similar backgrounds, and we both came from cultures where it was like, you don't talk about your feelings. You get up, you go to work, you suck it up, and, you know, get on with life. So how did you talk to your kids about this kind of stuff?
I was fortunate because I moved away from here when my first child was 3 months old. So I lived in Sonoma County, and mm-hmm. I was completely away from my culture. And I think that was the best benefit I ever had because I was able to develop who I might be, not who everybody else thought I would be. And so I was able to use different parenting stuff. And I based it, I think, all of it on what I didn't like about my experience. Mm-hmm. And I did let them pretty much say what they wanted to say. And they only had, we were laughing about it the other day, they only had like one rule, really, and that was don't upset your mother. They could do whatever they wanted as long as it didn't upset me. And, you know, a couple of times they did, and one time one didn't get to go to a prom, and another time they didn't have a car for a week, and, you know, I was pretty severe about that, but they very rarely stepped over those lines, and they had a lot of freedom.
Were there things you learned about parenting that you experienced with your own parents that you decided you weren't going to practice on your kids?
That's exactly pretty much where I came from. But the other thing I did, as I look back, and I don't think it was conscious at the time, was I did have boundaries for them. But I figured out how to expand them. My parents weren't very good at that, you know. Mm-hmm. When I was 16, they thought I should still be wearing Bobby socks and staying home at night and never going to a football game. So, you know, I expanded theirs much quicker than my parents did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of was able to look at them, and they were pretty responsible, actually. I was very fortunate. My kids really were pretty responsible. My son was bullied in grammar school.
I don't think it was my daughter.
No. No. I don't think it was your daughter. I know who it was.
Sorry for bullying you, Susan's daughter, if you're listening to this. Sorry, we keep picking on you.
I know, I feel terrible. She's listening to you.
Well, that's okay. She's an adult, right?
Shout out. She is.
Also, feel free to call in. Our numbers are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. You're listening to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Linda Stansberry, and tonight we're talking about good advice. What advice would you give your younger self? So I'm going to fast forward a little bit to age 22. When I was 22, I graduated from college. I had some stuff that I was running from. I ran to Eastern Europe. I burnt through all of my money. I burnt through my parents' money. I came back broke with a big hole in one of my back molars, $1,000 in debt, nowhere to live. Had to go live with my parents. And still the advice I give to people who are, you know, between the ages 20 and 25 is to go travel and to make lots of mistakes and make lots of mistakes while your brain is still malleable and you can learn from those mistakes, you know, because our brains don't finish forming until we're 24, 25, right? And I think that making mistakes and failing at stuff can be really valuable. Maybe don't make the same mistakes I made, you know, make gentler mistakes. Yeah, take care of your teeth. Other stuff, you know, alcohol doesn't really solve your problems. It just kind of fills them up for a while. What about you guys? Are you 22 yet?
Yeah, I just turned 27.
Aw, nice.
But it's hard to remember 5 years ago already.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so 22. At 22, I was working at Ramon's Bakery and Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I really like to serve other people coffee. It's a really quick, happy exchange. Everybody's satisfied unless you make it wrong. So then it's your fault, so you should be blamed. But I think one of the most important lessons for 22, when I was 22, I was sitting on the beach in Petrolia, and the person that I considered my mother told me that she was dying from cancer and that she wasn't going to be surviving. And that it was coming back, and she just knew that she wasn't going to face it anymore. And it was kind of this very, like, paradoxical moment for me, because it was kind of like this light clicked on about brevity. And around the same time I started working in oncology, I left Ramon's and got a very fluke opportunity to work in a clinic. And I worked with people who were dying every day. So 22 was really like 60 or 70 to me, because the people that I surrounded myself with were going through really difficult experiences. And I really took it as an opportunity to glean as much wisdom as I could from those folks. And so there's often conversations about, you know, the things that they regretted or the things that they wish they had done with their lives, the things that made them happy, those sorts of things. And I found it really valuable. And I wrote a lot about those experiences that different people had for the sake of preserving it for myself and kind of trying to be mindful, you know, to integrate those things into my life at an early age. And I think one of the most important things that I learned that year was to live with intention. So instead of opportunities coming at you and you taking them because they're there, you know, romantic or not romantic, you know, for your livelihood or whatever, take the opportunity to seek the things that you want versus taking what's available. I think you find yourself down the road wishing, or maybe not wishing, but thinking, I could have done that differently if I had just been a little bit more present. So back to the conversation about being present in the here and now. That was definitely a big lesson for me, was recognizing intention and how valuable it is in life. 22. Yeah, good year.
Sounds like. What about you, Susan?
So I graduated from college. I got the job that I wanted in college as soon as I got out when I was 21, married my high school sweetheart, and was buying a house. It was really, everything fell into place just like it was supposed to. And I don't expect that happens for most people. So I really realized that I had a lot of luck with that. But when I look back at 22, I think I had no money and no time. And then I had kids, and I realized how much money and time I had before I had kids. So that, I think, is one of the biggest things, I think, when I see young people and they're like, oh, I have no time and I have no money. I'm like, oh, you have no idea. Like, squirrel a little way. This is my, like, financial literacy lesson. Save as much as you can, even if it's just $10, $20 a month in a retirement account. And then when you do have hard times and you can't squirrel it away, at least it continues to make money for you. Because I didn't. And now, you know, as you get older, you're like, dang it. You know, I should have had that making money for me then. So.
That's good advice.
Yeah, it's financial literacy advice.
No one thinks about finances when they're 22. I would not, some people think about finances when they're 22. Here I am talking smack about millennials.
I don't like that. Well, I don't think that's necessarily a millennial thing. When you're 22, you got so many interesting things to think about.
Yeah. I, for the record, again, I don't regret spending all my money on graphic novels in Amsterdam when I was 22. Just feels, you know, important life decision at that time. I still have those graphic novels. They might be worth something now.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Investment.
Yeah.
Financial literacy.
Books. What about you, Troy?
Let's see, 22. When I was 22, I was a strapping young lad enjoying life in Crescent City. Actually, I was in Pelican Bay Prison. Mm-hmm. I had graduated from Folsom Prison and been sent up this way to Pelican Bay. And I was serving a life sentence. And everybody I talked to, all the older guys, the administration, everybody was telling me that that life sentence meant that I would never, ever, ever, ever see the street again. And I listened to some of what they said, but I didn't let their reality become my reality. There was a little germ inside of me that kept on saying that, you know, one day I am going to be able to see the streets again, you know. And I saw what happened to the guys around me, that they believed what everybody was telling them about, you know, because I'm talking about not just the guy that you were in the cell with or the guys that you walk the track with on the yard or the older guys that you meet. I'm talking about administration, everybody. And they would tell you, you know, if you're alive, you're not going home. And some of them will tell you a little diplomatically and try to be soften the blow, and others will just tell you straight up, hey, look, your life, you're not going home. That's it, you know. What I would tell myself then is to hold on to that germ and feed it and water it, and that germ, knowing that you will see freedom again, that everybody's reality, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean your reality, you know. Just stay positive, keep doing what you got to do to kind of like dig your way out of where you're at, you know, and eventually you'll be out, you know. That's what I would tell myself, you know. That's what I would really like to go back and tell myself, because there were times when I kind of like, I don't know about this, you know. But it never fully just, you know, just was extinguished. I always had a little bit of it. And that's what I would tell myself. Just hold on to that.
How do you stay positive when people, everyone around you is saying that, though? Like, is that something that's inside you, or is that coming from somewhere else?
Well, it comes from inside of you, but also comes from, it's external and internal, you know. If you can have it internally and then have an outside voice also telling you, in my case, I did. I have a sister soul. She was really, you know, stepping into my life right then, you know, and she was kind of like, you know, starting to have a little influence on me, you know. And a lot of people didn't have that voice. They only had the voice that was around them, which was saying, hey, man, you know, you're a lifer. Why aren't you drinking this Bruno? Here, here's a cup. You're a lifer. Why aren't you blazing up this joint? Here, blaze it up, you know. You're a lifer. Why aren't you going with me across the yard and stab some guy because he owes me $50? You know, $50 is just enough to fill your gas, you know, unless you have a truck, and then you got to spend $65, you know. But, you know, they were willing to, you know, just give it all up because they didn't have that, you know, external and internal. You know, you got to have both, you know. And, yeah, you know, it's just, it wasn't easy, but, I mean, it's not impossible, you know. And every voice that you can hear that's a positive voice, sometimes it helps to dim out the negative voices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I survived, and that's how I held on to it.
Is that, do you find that like an inspiration for bringing that to other people too? Like, do you think that there's a lesson there for us in terms of bringing positivity to other people? Because
I think definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely, because even an ordinary person out here, getting in touch with somebody in there, you can say some extraordinary things that will really inspire that person or prevent that person from just totally teetering off into the negative end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how long did you serve? Like, how long were you actually in?
Actually, I went in when I was 17, and I got out of San Quentin when I was 45.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it was 27 and a half years. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it seemed like it took forever, and sometimes it seemed like it was just, you know, just a few drops in the bucket of your life, you know. Yeah.
That's like your whole youth, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You know, it definitely is. And at the time that, you know, I was 17 when I first, you know, was arrested, you know, and the years that I was facing, I was thinking to myself, like, damn, it took forever to reach 17, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about 25 and 30 years, and I was like, wow, you know? And, you know, when you're 17, if you're looking at a 40-year-old, you're like, damn, dude, you're old, you know? Now I know that, if, you know, 40 is like the new 30 or something like that, or 25 even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of time left to you, you know. But yeah, there was a lot of youth just, I won't say wasted, but a lot of youth spent somewhere where I really didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's just how it is, you know. Yeah.
What about you, Jesse? 22?
When I was 22, I had two children, and I was working for the post office, and my friend Donna and I were the first two women mail carriers in Northern California. Not because they didn't allow women, but because they totally discouraged it, and it was very hard to get the job. But she and I applied shoulder to shoulder, and we both pressed on this postmaster in Petaluma, and he had to give us the job because we were qualified. But we had to go through things that young women today would never have to do to get a job like that. None of the men, they later told us, ever had to do what we had to do. We had to carry a sack of number one sacks, which weighed 80 pounds, across the dock and back.
Mm-hmm.
We had to load the semi-trucks that came in and unload them with the post in these great big bins. They would call us first for all these jobs. So, yeah, but after about 6 months, they started looking at us like, whoa, they're still here. So then I became the union representative for the Letter Carriers Association, and then I also became the representative for the Redwood Empire Letter Carriers Association, and I became their hero because they were married guys with families, and in those days, you know, they were scared to strike, and the post office couldn't strike the same way other people can. They could, but they couldn't just walk off the job. It's a different kind of union. So I would take the complaints, and I'd write them up, and I'd take them into the postmaster and demand this and that. So, yeah, I became their hero. They even gave me a gold watch when I quit, and I hadn't been there that long with my name and the whole thing on it. I loved that job. And my kids, I had to get up. I had to be at work at 6:30, so I had to have them at the babysitter's at 6. And they were babies. They weren't in school. So I was busy when I was 22. That was 1965.
You must have been strong as heck, like not just physically, but emotionally to do that kind of work.
Probably.
Yeah.
I always say I was very young and not too smart, so I was healthy. So. So yeah, well, it was hard with the kids, but the job was great because I got off at 3:30. So when they got in school, you know, I had the whole afternoon with them. So that was really good.
Would you do it all over again if you had to?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I loved that job. Mm-hmm. I really loved that job. That's when I started meeting people and learning from people, especially elders, because they're the ones who are home alone. Mm-hmm. And we were walking carriers. We were the only two women ever at that time up here. And little kids would come out and go, oh, it's a mommy mailman. But the elders would be standing there, especially in wintertime. Mm-hmm. They were so sweet, especially there was more widowers at that time, I think, for whatever reason. And they would be standing out there with a hot cup of cocoa or a hot cup of coffee with honey in it. One old man, he put honey in it for me. And you had to stop for at least 5 minutes and talk, which mm-hmm. was difficult because you were on a tight schedule, you know, to get all your deliveries done. But I couldn't walk off, and Donna couldn't either. We talked about it a lot. But that was my first lesson in lonely people who are living alone and what it was like for them.
And at the age you're at now, is that something you think about? Did that experience teach you something that prepared you for the age you are now or the experiences you have now?
I would say yes. I would say yes, because I looked at them, and of course I'm kind of a social creature, so I looked at them and thought, gosh, I would love to be able to just go and take them out to lunch and show them the senior center and show them things they could do. But of course, I couldn't. I mean, that was a massive need. And at that time, too, you have to remember, in 1965, there really weren't senior centers, and there weren't even women's shelters. There weren't anything mm-hmm. then, you know. So there really wasn't much to help these people. They were pretty much on their own except for us. Mm. And a lot of people over the years have been saved by postal carriers because of that regularity. And if they're not there, I went into many a house to see. And most of the carriers did. If they were on a regular route and they didn't see that person, you'd go knock on the door. So, yeah, we did our little public service.
That's really cool. And I want to throw it out to our listeners, by the way, that there are lots of opportunities to volunteer with elders in our community, you know, people who might not have like a really strong social network or a care network, and people who want to stay in their homes as they get older, and also people who are in long-term care facilities that could really use volunteers to work with them. So if you have any questions about that, just call in or let me know.
Oh, could I say something about long-term care? Recently, I had a friend who was in long-term care, and I went through the paperwork to bring my little dog. I have a little tiny dog, Odie. Mm-hmm. Linda knows Odie.
She's terrifying.
And I took her in with me to visit my friend, and all the people in there, almost every one of them, they loved her. And she's very user-friendly. You know, she would come in here and get up on any of your laps if you let her. And so she's very quiet. And I started going out there with this little dog, and that's a volunteer opportunity, just simply to take a little dog out there because you wouldn't believe how happy people are just to have her sit in their lap for 5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing to see. But it also takes you a half hour to get to your friend's room and a half hour because of all the people. They come out in their wheelchairs when they'd see me coming because they got used to it. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's really nice. And again, to our listeners, numbers to call in are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. And tonight, my name is Linda Stansberry. We're doing the Good Advice Show, and I have a bunch of people here with a bunch of different life experiences, and we're talking about what advice would you give your younger self? What advice do you wish people, you know, what do you wish that people knew about you, about your experience? What advice would you give your parents if you could go back in time? Again, I have with me Ms. Jamie Carroll, Ms. Susan Seaman, Mr. Troy Williams, and Ms. Jessie Wheeler. And starting off again with you, Jamie, I guess, first of all, I kind of backtracked when I was 27. You're 27, is that right?
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is really exciting. Not that I want you to do this because you're about to start school and you're on a whole different path. But when I was 27, I decided that I wasn't going to worry about raising kids, like getting married, buying a house, or any of that stuff, mostly because it just wasn't happening. And instead, I was going to save all my money and travel around the world when I turned 30. So that's what I did. It was an awesome decision. I don't regret it at all. And if I were to go back to give myself advice again when I was 27, I would say just do that. Like, don't change anything. So, and if you're listening and you're wondering, you know, should I do that? Yes, you absolutely should. If you can, you should just quit buying anything except for, like, toothpaste and new underwear and save all your money and then go travel. It doesn't take a whole lot of money either.
Apply for a passport. It's a whole different experience now.
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. And if you get a visa for India, don't tell them that you're a writer or a journalist, because then it takes like an extra like 2 months while they try to make sure you're not going to like, you know, blow them up.
That's a good topic for another show.
But I don't have any more shows.
You're
it's my
have to
last
come back
show.
As a guest.
So what about you? You're getting ready to start school. How are you feeling about this? Like, especially coming back as a student at 27, do you feel like, yes, I'm on the right path?
I do, actually. So I have attempted school a number of times, but growing up in a situation like mine, a very unique one, I've basically been in a survival mode for a long time. And so now it kind of feels like I actually feel like school is a luxury to a degree. And so for that, I'm feel really fortunate for the opportunity to even consider it right now. It's just through a series of fortunate events, I guess, or something like that. But I've never been called to higher education because things have come naturally for me as far as career. And I'm most recently made more than a college graduate, for the last 5 years. And so I just never felt like I needed to. But I'm getting to the point where I have to consider what my future is going to look like and, you know, what investment am I going to make for myself and whatever future comes along. So I feel really good about it. I feel like it's a good decision. I'm hoping that, you know, that it means something by the time I'm done, considering mm-hmm. the state of the union. But I feel like, if anything, coming back to school at an older age, I believe that I will look at the resources I have with more gratitude mm-hmm. than I would have at a younger age. And for that, I feel grateful because I'll hopefully soak it all up. So,
awesome. We do have a caller on the line. We have Bobby in Fortuna. How's it going, Bobby?
Better than most.
Hey.
That's a good answer.
So what can we help you with? You got a question?
Yeah, my question is, how in your own life and in your professional life do you deal with victims who don't recognize that they're victims and want to continue to engage in destructive behavior and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to walk away and say adios, and then maybe you'll eventually see the light. Or how do you deal with it?
So you're talking about people that you want to help but won't accept your help? Or people that you think need to take more responsibility?
Well, I'm one of those people that has a lot of insight into people's lives, and I give advice, but I don't attach any emotion to it. If they take the advice, fine. If they don't, I simply say, adios, and then a couple of letters that are not illegal, MF, and go from there. But once in a while, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
Good question. Anyone else want to take that?
Well, I found from where I was at that I try to give a little, especially after I had been in the prison system for a while, I tried to give a little insight and advice to the younger guys that I saw coming in. And
there's no worse place for victims than prison. So, right, go on.
Well, what I would try to do is tell the person that, you know, the situation that you're in right now, it's not going to be permanent unless you do things to make it permanent. And I would try to...
I understand all those things. This person just won't listen.
Well, if a person can't listen, you know, I mean, you can't force someone... Well, it depends on how much you got invested in this person, you know?
I'm not going to take no for an answer.
Hang on, Bobby. Let Troy finish his thought.
If it's someone that's, you know, intricately attached to you, you know, a relative or just someone you've known as a friend forever, you're going to want to invest more of yourself into seeing this person better themselves. But if it's someone that you just met, you know, down the street, you hardly know this person, I mean, you can't bend over backwards to get this person to take your advice. You know, you got to know when, you know, your advice is being taken and when it's just being wasted, you know. If you feel like it's being wasted, I mean, you just can't keep wasting it, I guess, you know. You gotta know when to draw the line.
You gotta know when to hold them, you gotta know when to fold them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You've been reading my mail, honey.
Bobby, when I was 24, my sister came back to California after living in Georgia for about 10 years. And
I'm sure I can't understand you.
When I was 24, my sister came to California after living in Georgia for about 10 years, and she had a mental break, and she became dependent on methamphetamines. And I tried really hard to be, you know, a present, very participating person in her life. And it was a difficult moment to come to the realization that you have certain roles that you play in people's lives. And when it comes to the act of listening and to being a victim or to, you know, helping somebody come to terms with their victimhood, it's often a journey that they have to find on their own. And it really sucks when you have to, you know, when you have to dismiss yourself from the experience, basically. Because we never want to give up on anybody, right? That's, you know, it's kind of our nature to want to help a brother out or a sister out. But there comes a time when your language isn't the language that they speak.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, that does happen, and it happens with important people.
My response is, you can lead a horse to water, but a pencil must be led.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. That's what I was thinking.
and this person, anyway, yeah.
Well, Bobby.
I understand all that stuff. Totally.
I mean, Bobby, this is Linda, and, you know, coming from a background of recovery and from working with addicts and alcoholics in recovery, you know, just as an example, sometimes you have to do what you have to do to protect yourself, you know, and keep your own mental health and your own sanity. And sometimes that means, you know, not interacting with someone if they're making unhealthy decisions. And sometimes when someone is making unhealthy decisions, your choice not to be around them or not to be in their life is part of the consequences that gets them to a place where they're ready to accept help or to accept change. And, I mean, it feels awful when you do it, but, you know, you also got to take care of yourself.
I didn't feel bad at all when I did that. Mm-hmm. I was helping a friend about 5 years ago. And I had to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to call her and say I couldn't help you because I was homeless. And if I can't help myself, How can I help you?
That's very real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Bobby. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Bobby, thank you for calling
right
in.
Right now, I recovered, and so I can do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you for calling in, Bobby, and we wish you the very best of luck. And it sounds like you're a really good friend and a really caring person. So good, take good care of yourself, okay? All right, so the numbers to call in, guys, are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. And tonight's show is a good advice show. We have a bunch of people here with a wide variety of life experiences. We're giving advice. We're giving advice to ourselves. We're talking about, you know, if we can go back and do it differently, what we would have done. And we are on Susan. We are age 27. What would you tell your 27-year-old self?
So I guess I should start by saying that one of the things I'm noticing in this room is I have a lot of privilege. So my situation and the advice that I have comes from a place where there's just a lot of stability and a lot of support. And this isn't when I was 27. My dad died when I was 19. Mm-hmm. There's my sad little story. But he left me a letter for graduation, and he told me, if you have two characteristics, be kind and be dependable. Mm-hmm. And I post that every year. I always think it's so important. Be kind and be dependable. And he's like, you know, that'll get you through. That'll get you through. It'll make things easy. And it does. And people like to work with you. And you lead a relatively drama-free life. And I was thinking about that. And actually, in terms of privilege, because there are so many things in this world that really kind and dependable aren't going to fix it. So you need to be more than that. And so I realize that when I'm talking to people, I need to realize that I'm coming from the place that, you know, if everything's going right, this is probably what works.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was 27, I was actually finishing college. I walked in 1991, but did not get my degree until 1996 because math. I had one class, and it was really more hard to get into than it was to pass. It was just always impacted, and then I started having a kid. I was 9 months pregnant, walking up Founders Hall. So probably finished the class in early May and had my daughter in late May.
Mm.
So I was finishing my degree. I was continuing to work at my job, where I was growing some independence there. I guess the biggest thing I learned, and it was about that time, there was a woman that worked with me, and I'd get so irritated with her because she got everything she wanted. And I was like, why don't I get everything I want? And I think I asked her one day, and she said, I ask for it. And oh my God, that totally worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome. I started asking for what I wanted, and it was amazing what I could accomplish. So that was my next advice, was sort of know what you want, frame it so that it sounds like a good deal for whoever you're working with, and that's a good way to move forward.
Awesome. So, since we're in the last, you know, 10 minutes of our show, I'm feeling like the need to, like, move forward since we're only age 27. I didn't plan this very well. So I guess, you know, talking to you, Troy, like, how have you looked at life differently since you got out of prison?
Well, I feel like Jamie in terms of my experience here at the university. I really like being here, mm-hmm. and I think it is a privilege to be here. And you know, just when you're in a place where something as simple as a tree is not accessible to you, and when you come and you're surrounded by millions of trees, you still appreciate all those trees, every single one of them, you know. And you know, I learned that, you know, the simple things in life are what you really, really get that fulfillment from, you know, just like being able to just relax, put some John Coltrane on and have it coming at you with some nice speakers and just, you know, you don't need a fast car, you just need some beautiful music coming at you and it'll help make you feel good, you know. And I don't know, at 27, I was just starting to realize that in terms of people, there's really not too much differences, you know. There were different groups in there, but each of the groups had, like, guys that were, like, scurrilous and you wanted to stay away from, and guys that were, like, really upstanding, and you're like, damn, you ask yourself, I wonder what brought him in here, you know. And I was starting to see that, you know, there's not much that divides us except for the stuff that we structure, you know, different classes, different races and whatnot, you know. But within the groups, you know, there was a little bit of everything, you know. And I don't know, you know, what was the question again? I'm curious to know, though, uh-huh. What class was that? Was it stats?
I think I ended up taking stats for non-math majors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I for have years, for 20 years, I've been saying that I almost failed that class.
Yeah.
My son works in the library here, and he's like, I could find your transcripts. I got an A-.
Mm-hmm.
That's so. Not bad at all.
Oh, so, yeah. You and me, Susan. I hear you. I got a B-plus in college. I was just down on myself. I was like, oh no, it's all over.
Well, no, I totally thought I almost mm-hmm. failed it. I was like, how did I even, I had no idea I did so well.
Yeah.
You gotta admit, though, looking at all those A's really makes you feel good. But no one's keeping track of any of that stuff, you know, except for, you know, some records.
Yeah, there were some records.
That's the thing, though. I made it through, like, pretty much my entire academic career just getting A's and not appreciating any of them. Like, I was just, you know, for a long time in my life, I had this accomplishment, you know, deficit. Like, I wouldn't allow myself to feel proud of accomplishments, like it was never enough. You're pointing at me. You say, do you guys hear me? Yeah.
I think that's a really important one. Mm-hmm. Recognize your accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Quiet the critic. That's what I would say.
And don't beat yourself up over the B+. Mm. Which a lot of people do.
I don't anymore. You know, when I went back to school, this is Linda, by the way, listeners. When I went back to school at, like, how old was I? I was like 27, 28, I kind of just, you know, skated, like, through my classes at CR to become a drug and alcohol counselor because I was working full-time, and I was like, you know, it's okay, I'm going to be C even. Like, I didn't like it, you know, but...
C is pushing it. Yeah.
All right, Troy's my new life coach.
Troy is a life coach.
What about you, Jesse? What advice would you give your 27-year-old self?
Oh, 27, I was helping my husband get his business going, and I was working in the first Sonoma County Women for Shelter project that started in the 70s. And that was quite an eye-opener. I really got involved in that. I worked a hotline for a long time, and then I became an advocate. And that was a real eye-opener, because in the 70s, there were not protections for women like there are now. There was zero protection. And even the police department would put those calls on, they would put it on the lowest priority. They get 5 calls, that one went to the bottom. Mm-hmm. I learned an awful lot. I learned about elder abuse then, because they didn't have any place else to go, so we had some elders call us. And I was very naive. I had no idea the extent that went on. It was really a big lesson for me, big lesson. But it was a very rewarding thing to do. Because I had regular people, we had regular shifts, and I had people who would call me. Same people, they'd know my shift, and this other women did too. They had regular people. It would depend on you to be there to listen to them. And I had a couple call me back and tell me that they had got out of their situation and thank me for being there because they had someone to talk to. they ultimately had to do it on their own, but it was really rewarding, mm-hmm. really rewarding thing to do. So,
you know, I have to say, like, I really admire everything that you've accomplished and everything that you've done in your life, and you're still doing stuff, like, you're still really busy, and so how... I don't know. So, like, personally, like, at the end of the day, I just want to go home and put my feet up, you know? So how do you stay motivated? And what are your goals for the next 20 years?
I take a lot of naps. I've limited myself. I've cut back on mm-hmm. a lot of stuff I do. I'm part of the Redwood Village thing, mm-hmm. which I really think is a great deal. I belong to Humboldt Pioneers and Daughters of the Golden West and things like that. I go to, you know, they all have once a month meetings. But I take a lot of naps. And I've started putting big zeros on days in the calendar on either side of when I'm going to do something. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow has a zero on it.
So tomorrow's a do-nothing right. day? Oh, I want one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, once I got past 70, you know, it's like I realized I had to kind of pull the reins in. Or there wasn't going to be anything left.
So in the last couple of minutes we have left, I just want to throw it out there. This is kind of a cheesy thing, but if you were going to describe yourself or your accomplishments in one word 10 years from now, what word would you want to use? And I'll start with you, Jamie.
No, I'm not first this time.
Oh, all right. I'll start with you, Susan.
So what word would I use if I describe myself 10 years from now?
Yeah, what word would you like to be used to describe you 10 years from now?
I don't know. Kind and dependable.
Hey,
there you go. Stick with it.
Consistent. What about you? Is it going to be Dr. Williams?
Yeah. I don't know yet.
Huh?
But I would say, aside from not knowing, I would mm-hmm. say diligent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm always going. I'm always going. Yeah. Yeah. Diligent, yeah.
Nice. What about you, Jesse?
I want to borrow some words. Mm-hmm. She persisted.
Nice. I want to be able to describe myself as a triathlete before I turn 40. I don't know if that's going to happen, but sometimes I go to the gym, so, you know, I'm getting closer.
I'm there at 6:30. You should come and join me.
Oh. All right, back to you, Jamie.
Impactful.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
All right, well, I want to thank all of y'all for joining me on my last show. It was really lovely. You guys...
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you guys were great. And I want to thank all of our listeners, and I've had a really great time hosting the show. And thank you very much to my Thursday Night Talk family. I love y'all. All right, bye.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Many thanks to Linda Stansbury and guests for a lively discussion. We love to get feedback on our programs. You can share your thoughts on the KHSU comment line at 826-6089. Thanks to Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. I'm Jesse. I've been your engineer tonight. Did you know that only 1 in 10 youth eligible for free summer meals get those meals? On the next Thursday Night Talk, host Brenda Starr discusses the summer food service program here in Humboldt County with guests from Eureka City Schools, Food for People, and Marshall Family Resource Center. That's next Thursday Night Talk, July 13, beginning at 7. We've got plenty more great programming just ahead. I hope you stay with us. Jazz is on deck with No Room for Squares.
Emotions are powerful things. Sometimes it feels like they just take you over.
But what if that's not the way it works? What if we've been thinking about emotions all wrong?
Sometimes you can let emotions control your behavior.
This week, Invisibilia is looking at a whole new way of thinking about our emotions. That's Invisibilia from NPR.
Friday evening at 7 on KHSU.
You've been listening to Thursday.